Doctor, and I'm here today with my partner, Jennifer Fay. We're also very pleased to be with Dr. Dan McQuillan, the Vice Chair of Infectious Diseases at the Leahy Clinic. We've retained Dr. McQuillan to provide our clients with medical as well as practical advice and expertise regarding the steps our clients should take if faced with an outbreak of the swine flu in their workplace. Dr. McQuillan is going to open our discussion by providing an overview of the current status of the virus, some practical advice concerning antiviral drugs and treatment, some historical perspective on the current outbreak of swine flu and its medical and economic impact as compared to past outbreaks of the influenza virus. And then, importantly, Dr. McQuillan is going to offer some practical advice regarding signs and symptoms of the swine flu, how to avoid getting it, including likely means of transmission, and some practical advice to employers confronted with employees who are displaying symptoms or who have been diagnosed with the swine flu. Jennifer and I are going to follow Dr. McQuillan and discuss several of the employment issues confronting employers, including general obligations employers have under the Occupational Safety and Health Act. Also, we will discuss miscellaneous employment issues under state workers' compensation law, as well as federal and state leave laws, like the Family Medical Leave Act, as well as disability law. We will also address important matters employers should address regarding their existing employment policies, including leave and vacation policies, working from home, and wage payment issues. We'll also focus on important privacy and confidentiality matters. A few administrative points. By logging into this webinar, PowerPoint slides have been made available to you. To a great extent, we are going to be following those outlines in those slides during our presentations. These outlines also include links to other helpful websites. An audio recording of today's presentation, as well as copies of these PowerPoint slides, will be available to each of you through the Goodwin Proctor website at www.goodwinproctor.com. In addition, please feel free to contact us with questions that may arise during the course of the panel discussion today. To ask a question, simply type it in the question box on your control panel and click Send to submit. To the extent that we have time at the conclusion, we will attempt to address some of these questions. Without further ado, I'd like to turn now to Dr. McQuillan.
Thank you, Brad. Let me go to the next slide. As Brad mentioned, I am an infectious disease doctor practicing north of Boston, and I'm going to give you a little bit of background on influenza in general, and then swine flu in particular. First off, in our normal seasonal influenza seasons outbreaks, we'll see somewhere around 36,000 deaths and over 200,000 hospitalizations and can have up to 50 million people infected, which leads to 70 million missed work days, 38 million missed school days, and up to $15 billion in costs. Just a little bit about what types of influenza viruses we're looking for. Most commonly, we'll see influenza A causing human infection, and it's highly variable, which leads to the need to change vaccines every year, but also will cause more severe disease than the other two types. Also, importantly, it infects a lot of different species, including humans, birds, pigs, and that'll become important when we discuss the swine flu virus. It's the most common, and the major global pandemics in the past, in 1918, 1957, and 1968, have all been caused by type A influenza. Just a little bit about how we come about the different types of viruses. A, B, and C are based on the M or matrix protein, which surrounds the genetic code that's contained inside the virus particle. And then the subtypes, what you hear about H1, N1, that sort of thing, are two different proteins, neuraminidase and hemagglutinin, that are the factors that allow the virus to get into, infect, and get out of cells. Flu vaccines are made up of those H and N antigens that we talked about in the last slide. And each year we pick the types that are predicted to be the most common ones that are circulating around. Importantly, the seasonal vaccine that you got this past season, and the one you'll get next season does not protect against this new H1N1 swine flu strain. That's part of what's being discussed right now as to whether that will be incorporated in the vaccine next season or whether we'll need to have a separate vaccine. In the positive category, the current swine flu virus is sensitive to Tamiflu, which is our most common new antiviral drug. It blocks the action of that neuraminidase protein we talked about and stops the spread of the virus from one cell to the next. If you start it within the first 2 days of symptoms, you can cut the disease duration of symptoms by 1 to 3 days. There's a second drug called Relenza that's not used as often, mainly because it's an inhaler that often causes coughing fits, but it does work just as well. The older medicines don't work against this particular virus. Where do you find influenza in nature? It basically resides in wild aquatic birds like ducks and shorebirds and typically doesn't cause any problems for them. But these viruses can readily jump into domesticated birds and then pigs as well. Pigs are important because they can be infected by both avian or bird influenza viruses and human influenza viruses. When you get that situation, you get sort of like a mixing bowl. If a pig has the two different ones at the same time, they can exchange genes and reassort and then cause a virus that's infectious in people. Looking at the major pandemics, you'll see that we had a really large one that had very high mortality in 1918 and 1919, and it was the same H1N1 type as the current swine flu virus. But as more is being found out about the current outbreak, the genetic material in each of these is quite different, and that may explain why it's not as severe in the current outbreak. That circulated around until about 1950 when there was a shift to H2. Since most of the population hadn't seen this new type, we had another pandemic. Same thing happened in 1968 when there was a shift to H3. And as you can see in the top part of the graph here, there are a number of different avian influenza viruses that caused an outbreak in 2005. We're waiting for the next pandemic. It's really unclear whether it will be one of those avian viruses or the H1 that we're seeing now. Just a little bit about what kind of cost you'd get in these different pandemics. What we talked about before in the first column about ordinary influenza season is there. If we had one similar to 1918, we would basically ramp our deaths up to about $1,200,000, $5 to $6 million hospitalizations, maybe 180 million people infected, and untold costs in terms of our economy, and this is just in the U.S. That was really what impacted the strong response and the very conservative response to this current outbreak. As of yesterday evening, you can see on this graph where all the cases have been, and while it was first discovered in Mexico and most of the deaths have been there, there are cases in North America, South America, Europe, and as far away as New Zealand. So it's clearly a global virus at this point. Next. One of the few things that the last administration did really well was establish the pandemic influenza plan. And this was put in place at the time of the avian flu outbreak. And what we're seeing in the past couple of weeks is this plan in action. And it's really worked incredibly well in this country to, I think, limit spread so far and get antiviral medications out to areas where they can be used if necessary. It's actually been a very good test. In some quarters, Boston being one of them, some of the tabloids have played this up quite a bit. This was the Herald's front page earlier this week when we had our first cases in Massachusetts. It turns out that it's probably not the killer flu, and we'll talk a little bit about what's going on currently. Again, we first saw this virus in the U.S. in April 2009. Many, if not all, of the cases in the U.S. have had contact or travel to Mexico. It's been spreading person to person, much like seasonal flu, so that's not unusual. Again, it's initially called swine flu because at first glance it looked like genes that we would see in pig influenza in North America, but it's been found to contain genes from pigs in Europe and Asia, one avian gene, and also a human gene. So it's an entirely new virus. In terms of what you'd look for if you had someone or you yourself got swine flu, it's not that atypical in that you'd see fever, cough, sore throat, body aches, headache, chills, and fatigue. But what is a little bit different about this one is that a significant number of people have also had diarrhea and vomiting, and that's a little bit unusual in terms of seasonal influenza. Again, the severity is unknown, but thus far in the United States, it's not been more severe than our seasonal influenza is. How do you keep from getting the flu? First and most importantly, you have to wash your hands on a frequent basis. You try to stay in good general health, and there are a number of things everyone knows how to do that. Try not to touch surfaces that may be contaminated with the flu virus and avoid close contact with people who have flu symptoms. How long can an infected person spread this virus? The current belief is that, again, it's pretty much the same properties in terms of spread as the seasonal flu viruses, and in those, people are contagious from a day before they get symptoms to up to a week after. However, in children, especially young children, they might be contagious for longer periods of time, so you have to keep that in mind. What surfaces are most likely to be sources of contamination? Droplets from cough and sneeze in an infected person go through the air, and they land on the surfaces around them. Any kind of germ can be spread when a person touches those respiratory droplets that have come from another person on a surface like a desk, and then touch their own eyes, mouth, or nose before washing their hands. Influenza virus can survive on a desktop or something like it and be able to be infectious for up to 2 to 8 hours after being deposited on that surface. So what can you do to protect yourself and others from getting sick? Well, aside from washing hands, which we'll cover a million times, cover your nose and mouth with a tissue or your sleeve if you don't have a tissue handy when you cough or sneeze. You should then throw that tissue in the trash after you use it. Obviously, again, you want to wash your hands often with soap and water, especially after coughing or sneezing. Alcohol-based hand cleaners that are easily available are also very effective, especially against neutralizing influenza viruses. And again, avoid touching your eyes, nose, or mouth if you've not washed your hands. If you're sick and develop flu-like symptoms, you should stay home for 7 days after your symptoms begin or until you're symptom-free for 24 hours, whichever is longer. And really, that's to keep social distance to help you not infect others. So issues for employers. In terms of travel, as you'll recall, there was not a complete ban, but a warning against travel to Mexico when this first broke out. Basically, people who are coming back to the States and exhibiting symptoms that are consistent with swine flu and who've traveled to an infected area or have been exposed to someone who's possibly infected during the last week, they should report their illness to their healthcare provider immediately. And sick employees should stay home if sick for 7 days after symptoms or until symptom-free for 24 hours, whichever is longer. So if you have an employee that calls you up, what should you ask them? First off, you want to find out if the employee has typical symptoms, and the case definition that the CDC is using is an acute febrile illness, which means a temperature over 100 degrees Fahrenheit, with a recent onset of a runny nose, nasal congestion, sore throat, or cough. And then you want to find out if they've had exposure. Have they been in an endemic area, or have they been exposed to someone who's already been diagnosed with influenza A? And finally, have they seen their health care provider and been diagnosed with influenza A? So how does the testing work? Well, rapid ELISA testing is pretty widespread and is a test that will yield a result of either influenza A, influenza B, or neither within a couple of hours of the test being done. Some healthcare facilities will also perform a real-time PCR test, and that result will generally be available within 24 hours and is much more specific. In that test, the current H1N1 swine flu will be positive for influenza A, but it will be negative for H1 and H3 in the current test, and that's because the current tests are based on the circulating seasonal viruses. So a test that's positive in a person with compatible clinical illness is then forwarded to the CDC for confirmation. Massachusetts, among other state health departments, are starting to be able to do this test early, or this week, which will get your result earlier. Confirmation right now typically takes a couple of days to a week, mainly because of the delay in sending it to the CDC. So what does an employer need to report and to whom? Employees that have positive influenza A test results should be reported to your local, either city or state health departments, but in practice, the positive results are going to be reported by their health care provider, so I don't think it's incumbent upon the employer to do that reporting. But if you have clusters of people with influenza-like illness, that probably should be reported. How many workers do you need to send home if they're exposed to a sick employee? Generally, you select out the employees who are in close contact with the sick employee and have significant exposure. In practice, this means employees who spent significant time within 3 to 6 feet of that employee, which is the typical range respiratory droplets can spread. In the past, for seasonal influenza, we're usually using about 3 feet. Early on in this epidemic, we've been using 6, mainly because we're not really sure what the parameters of this kind of transmission are yet. And if you've got multiple sick employees, again, the local health department will probably catch wind of it at some point and be involved in the decision about who stays and who goes home. Importantly, cleaning crews should probably be doing a little bit more than they would normally do. The CDC recommends using EPA-registered disinfectants with label claims for influenza A virus, and they should be used with non-sterile gloves to protect the workers' hands on general use surfaces, basically toilets, bathrooms, faucets in the sinks, general hand contact surfaces such as door handles, telephones, keyboards, mice, arms of chairs, table and desktops, that sort of thing. This should be applied with a disposable cleaning towel, usually paper is best, and then the gloves and the towel should be collected in a leak-proof plastic bag that's tied shut and not reopened before it's disposed. Obviously, when they're done cleaning, the crews should clean their own hands with soap and water or an alcohol-based hand gel. Our vice president weighed in on this earlier this week and gave part of the message. But does it make any sense to keep recent Mexico travelers with no symptoms out of the workplace? At this point, I would say no, mainly because the epidemic in Mexico appears to be leveling off, and if the workers are asymptomatic, it's unlikely that they're going to develop disease and would warrant keeping them out of the workplace. The WHO has come out and said definitively that limiting travel and imposing travel restrictions would have very little effect on stopping the virus from spreading, but would be highly disruptive to the global community. Influenza A, H1N1, has already been confirmed in many parts of the world, as you'll recall from that map we showed earlier. The focus now is really on minimizing the impact of the virus through rapid identification of cases and appropriate medical care. In our area, there were a number of schools that were closed down because there was a child or two that had influenza-like illness or may have been diagnosed with influenza A, and the issue has come up several times about what to do about their parents. And in this specific question, if the schools have been closed and the employee has children that are going to that school but they're not sick, is there any medical reason to keep the employee out of work? And in this case, the employee likely hasn't been directly exposed to influenza, so there's not really a medical reason to keep that person out of work. Steps you can take, primarily stay informed, and I'll give you a number of resources where you can get on the web and get the latest updates on the current state of the outbreak and recommendations. You want to educate your employees about steps to avoid getting or spreading the virus. You want to give them the tools they need to stay healthy, providing hand sanitizer, the alcohol hand rub in public areas, encouraging them to stay home if they're truly sick with an influenza-like illness. Do not allow staff to bring their sick children into the office. Encourage people to telecommute or stay home and take care of their sick children when appropriate. And then ensure continuity of operations, which is really a planning thing. You want to review your plan and revise it to reflect any changes that have happened in your organization. And if you don't have a plan, you should develop one. The Pandemic Flu website has an excellent business checklist that can lead you through that process. And the Massachusetts Department of Health has a Steps for Employers guide that's also very handy. And these are additional resources. The top one is the current update every day that's up to the minute from the CDC. The Massachusetts website has a similar one. WHO website is listed, and the pandemic flu website is there as well. And thanks very much. I'm going to hand it back to Brad and Jen.
All right. Thanks, Dr. McClellan. We're going to focus on some of the employment issues that really derive from Dr. McQuillan's presentation. First of all, looking at OSHA. OSHA is the federal agency charged with enforcing the federal Occupational Safety and Health Act, and OSHA issues safety standards to employers in a variety of industries. And generally, those safety standards address industry-specific activity. Now, although there's no OSHA standard governing an employer's response to an outbreak of disease, the Occupational Safety and Health Act does include this general duty clause, which requires employers to provide their employees with a workplace free from recognized hazards likely to cause death or serious physical harm. Now, OSHA has issued guidance encouraging employers to educate themselves and their employees regarding the risks related to an influenza pandemic and being prepared in advance for such a pandemic. Now, importantly, OSHA generally looks to the Center for Disease Control or other public health agencies for guidance regarding the seriousness of any influenza outbreak, and they will react accordingly. OSHA has also indicated that it will enforce its authority under the General Duty Clause consistent with the recommendations or requirements that may be issued by the CDC or Department of Public Health in the event of a pandemic. Now, in other words, employers need to obviously follow those recommendations or requirements as issued by those federal agencies and or risk being violation of the General Duty Clause if they fail to do so. Now, Dr. McQuillan referenced the development of a written emergency plan or a written plan that employers should consider to address the variety of issues that arise in the face of an outbreak. Importantly, OSHA doesn't require an employer to have such a written emergency plan, at present such plans are voluntary, they strongly encourage them. Now, any emergency plan, to the extent that an employer adopted one, should include matters such as hygiene in the workplace, including a review of a regularity of hand washing stations, provision of other hand washing alcohol-based gel for employees, the spacing of employee workstations, you know, training of employees regarding hygiene, including important issues like social distancing and cough etiquette. An emergency plan would also address the development and revision of a company's existing employment policies that would be intended to control the transmission of the disease between employees. These policies, you know, would include requiring employees to report immediately the fact that they have been diagnosed with or are suspected of having a serious communicable disease that is occurring, particularly when it's concurrent with an outbreak of a declared emergency. An emergency plan could also address policies such as attendance, telecommuting, travel and vacation policies, which, by the way, Jen and I will touch briefly on each of those later in this presentation. And an emergency plan, importantly, would also provide for a system of ongoing communication between all employees who may be remote from the company in the event of a pandemic. Ultimately, an effective emergency plan can anticipate the extraordinary challenges facing an employee in the event of a temporary loss of a significant portion of the workforce or even a shutdown and help to minimize the significant financial impact of those events. Now, in addition to the emergency plan, there is a very limited, narrow circumstance when an employee may lawfully refuse to work based on the employee's good faith belief that he or she has been exposed to an imminent danger. Now, the imminent danger exception requires that the employee have asked the employer to eliminate a danger in the workplace, but the employer has failed to do so. And in that case, if the employee believes in good faith that the employee is going to be exposed to a real danger of death or serious injury, and there isn't time for OSHA to intervene, then the employee can lawfully refuse to report to work and cannot be retaliated against or disciplined for doing so. Now, in general, obviously here, the CDC has not made any significant recommendations regarding the closing of businesses in your locales as a result of an outbreak. But if that occurred and an employer ignored those recommendations, or, you know, in the face of an outbreak, completely ignored reasonable hygiene responsibilities that it had to its employees, then an employee logically may be able to take the position that there was an imminent danger to the extent that there was a significant pandemic. We're not faced with that now, but clearly, statistically, it could happen. The last OSHA topic is record keeping. Many employers in the production, manufacturing, and construction industries are required to maintain what's known as the OSHA Form 300, which is the form that records each work-related injury and illness that results in medical treatment, restricted work, or days away from work. Now, although there's no specific guidance regarding OSHA record keeping in the event of a transmission of influenza in the workplace, there is guidance, specific guidance regarding tuberculosis, which specifically requires an employer to record each incident where an employee has been occupationally exposed, meaning through work, to someone with TB and subsequently develops the TB infection. As a result, we do expect that OSHA would require an employer who is subject to these record-keeping requirements to record any incident where an employee has contracted the influenza virus because of work-related contact. Keep in mind, though, that if it's later determined that despite the exposure in the workplace, it is later medically determined that the employee contracted the disease because of an out-of-work exposure, no such record-keeping need be made. Thanks, Jen.
Okay. Thank you, Brad. The next issue that we want to touch on is relates to workers' compensation and concerns that employers may have about claims of common law negligence. Now, when faced with an employer, with a pandemic, this would be one of the most very important point for our clients to consider. More specifically, what if an employee clearly contracted the virus at work? What if that employee became very ill and perhaps even dies as a result of the illness? Could the company be sued for failing to do enough to protect the employee? Will the type and scope of the employee communications be scrutinized? And will the failure to require potentially exposed employees to stay home be evidence of negligence? Well, as a threshold matter, much depends on whether the claims would be barred by the exclusivity provisions of the applicable workers' compensation statute. If an illness is deemed to be a personal injury within the various state law definitions, then the employee's sole remedy in that instance would be through the workers' compensation system, and the employer would not then be able to sue the employer directly. If, on the other hand, the employer is not sufficiently the illness is deemed not to be sufficiently work-related and falls outside of the perimeters of that particular workers' compensation statute, and again, they vary state by state, then the employee or the employee's estate, if in the unfortunate situation that the employee dies, may then bring common law negligence and related claims directly against the employer. Now, this slide shows just a sampling of the workers' compensation laws and illustrates how coverage may differ depending on the state in which the employee lives and works.
Let's focus for a moment on some compensation issues for employees who miss work due to the outbreak of a pandemic. Now, first of all, let's look at exempt employees. Exempt employees, as many of you know, are employees who are exempt from the requirement that the employer pay them overtime. These employees generally are exempt because of their duties and responsibilities, usually because they fall into an executive, administrative, or professional capacity. Now, in addition, under the relevant law, these exempt employees are required to be paid on a salary basis. What's a salary basis? Well, a salary basis is defined in both under the federal and relevant state wage law as being as a sum of money being paid on a predetermined amount that cannot be subject to reduction because of variations in the quality or quantity of the work performed. Now, because of this, the general rule is that an employer may not reduce an exempt employee's salary because the employee is absent for part of a work week. Now, additionally, however, the employer may require that the employee obviously use any accrued vacation or sick time as a substitute for that active wage. Also, in the event that the employee's absence is for personal purposes other than sickness or disability, the company may make deductions for full-day absences if the employee has exhausted whatever accrued paid time off the employee has. In addition, if an employee is absent for one or more full days because of illness, and the employee has exhausted his or her paid time off, including vacation or sick time, the employer can reduce the employee's salary in full-day increments, but only if that reduction is made pursuant to a company plan, policy, or practice that has been adequately communicated to employees. Importantly, then, as part of an employer's preparation for a pandemic or in general, an employer needs to verify that its absenteeism and paid time off policies provide that an exempt employee may have his or her salary reduced in whole day increments to the extent that the employee is absent and has exhausted all available time off. If the company does so, pursuant to such a bona fide policy, it will not jeopardize the salary basis or their exempt status. Now, finally, an employer may dock an exempt employee's pay for an entire work week, provided that the employee has not worked any time during that work week. All right, there are a few other issues, many arising under state law. One is that this is for non-exempt employees or employees who are paid generally on an hourly basis and are eligible for overtime. Under many state laws, they do provide that if an employee shows up for work and the employee makes himself or herself available for work, but the work is not available or the employee is sent home, then the employee is required to be paid for at least 3 hours for that show-up time. Now, generally, the employee must be paid at their regular rate of pay, whatever their compensation is, for the time actually worked up to that 3 hours, and at least the state minimum wage for the balance of that minimum of 3 hours. And again, show-up pay applies. If the person shows up for work and has not been notified by the company beforehand that work is unavailable or is otherwise if the employee is sent home for lack of work. Importantly, a few other issues. In the event that a non-exempt employee is telecommuting or working from home, the company does have an obligation to do appropriate wage hour record keeping. The company is required to record the total hours of the total number of hours worked each day and each work week. That record keeping requirement does apply to employees who are telecommuting. In addition, an employer is well advised to permit in advance or authorize in advance any overtime for telecommuting employees, particularly where the employee naturally is not going to have as extensive or indeed any control over a telecommuting employee. Note also that unemployment benefits under state law can be triggered for employees who are directed to stay home without pay. You know, in Massachusetts, if they're directed to stay home for 1 week, they are eligible for unemployment benefits for any period in excess of that 1 week waiting period.
Thanks, Brad. An issue that's certainly related to some of the pay issues that Brad just discussed, but really should be considered separately, is the issue of job protected leaves of absence. I often encourage clients to approach policy development and policy application issues by putting paid time off into one bucket and leave of absences into another and considering them separately and then figuring out how they interrelate. You know, it may be the case that an employer is willing to adopt very generous and flexible time away from work policies, particularly in the environment that involves a pandemic, but it can't afford to, or it may not find it to be a prudent business practice to pay for all of those absences. And in many cases, of course, paid leave is not required. Now, of course, the granddaddy of all job-protected leaves is the FMLA, only applies to companies that have 50 or more employees, and with those employees work within a 75-mile radius. For those employers that are faced with FMLA, it's notable that in the cases of a pandemic, many absences may not actually be protected by the FMLA. It's only when an illness is sufficiently severe to rise to the level of being a serious health condition, either for the employer or for the employee, for the employee or for the employee's immediate family member, we really need to consider FMLA rights and obligations. If, on the other hand, an employee stays home from work to care for a healthy child, for example, or because the employee doesn't want to be exposed to the virus or because he or she has potentially been exposed to the virus but is not sick, then there may be time off, there may be leave policies that apply, but the FMLA will not. So in addition to the FMLA, other leave policies, either mandated by state law or voluntarily adopted by an employer, may apply. So in planning for a pandemic, employers should consider their existing policies and really test them by considering how they would apply to various groups of employees affected differently by a pandemic. Now, at the end of this session, Brad and I will provide you with a framework that we think will be helpful in this exercise. So determining if modifications to existing policies are necessary and or considering adopting new policies is something that may be an appropriate part of planning. Specifically, if there is, you may consider as an employer adopting a policy that is a pandemic-specific policy, such as a leave in connection with a communicable disease policy. Adopting such policies will enable the employer to consider business, health, fairness and employee relations issues that are likely to arise or become exacerbated by a pandemic, but may not necessarily be the driving forces behind the company's garden variety leave policies. So while pandemic-specific policies will help establish a framework, such policies, of course, should include discretionary and modification components to ensure that an employer can remain nimble and adjust to evolving circumstances in the event of a pandemic. Next, we address briefly the issues of confidentiality restrictions. This could be a potentially major issue for employers, or at least one that employers can become very concerned about. And that's considering what, if any, information they need to provide to their employees about others who may be ill or have been exposed to the virus. What if an employee becomes ill, has the flu, has been diagnosed with the flu, or simply has been exposed? Does that change the way in which employers are going to react? Well, starting with the very basics, medical information that an employer learns from or about one of its employees is, in fact, protected by the confidentiality provisions of the American with Disabilities Act. And that is true even if the condition doesn't rise to the level of being a disability under that law. Information obtained in connection with FMLA leave requests is also protected. Now, what the ADA does allow limited disclosure in certain narrow circumstances. However, disclosure to coworkers is not expressly permitted. Nevertheless, there may be times when revealing the identifying an ill or potentially ill person in the workplace may be prudent from a health and safety standpoint. In many cases, asking the affected employee to waive confidentiality protections to consent to such disclosure will be a simple way of accomplishing this. If no one objects to providing the information, that may solve the problem. It is, however, important not to coerce an employee into giving consent to reveal medical information. This is a tricky issue, and we really do recommend consulting with counsel and or medical personnel when determining the type and scope of notification that's appropriate to coworkers. A very quick word on privacy laws. Many states have them. A private right of action can arise if an employee, if an employer goes really too far in its disclosure. Public disclosure, of course, is to be avoided. Many employers also worry about HIPAA. I'm not going to say very much about that except to say don't worry as much as you may. HIPAA ordinarily does not apply to employers. It's only if the employer is acting in its capacity as a health plan sponsor, and even then there are exceptions that exist with respect to communicable disease risk.
Okay, let's talk about some policy development issues. First up is telecommuting, and importantly, it's very important for every company who permits employees to work from home to have a policy and a practice for determining who is permitted to work from home and who is not permitted to work from home. Significantly, a company should not simply let the employees choose on a day-to-day basis whether they are going to work from home. It is subject to abuse. It ends up being unproductive, and also can significantly affect morale. If the company does permit on a controlled basis telecommuting, it is important to have clear expectations about what work can be done from home and productivity requirements. The company also needs to challenge relevant supervisors and managers to provide the necessary oversight and review of work performed by employees who are telecommuting. In terms of the confidentiality, the company should also consider whether or not the employee's use of confidential information, either company information or client information, including accessing it from a home computer, could compromise confidentiality. Now, lastly, as I indicated, non-exempt employees, the company is required to record the actual hours worked during each workday and each work week, including when that employee is telecommuting. And importantly, you know, the company may want to institute as part of their telecommuting policy a requirement that a telecommuting employee receive the authority in advance before working any hours in excess of 8 hours per day or any other compensable overtime. Now, travel restrictions. Travel restriction policies. Generally speaking, the company should have a policy that indicates that it will or it may issue travel restrictions in conjunction with recommendations from the CDC or Department of Public Health or other relevant agency. A travel policy should also notify employees that it may require those employees to tell the company in advance of personal or family travel in the event that there is a perceived emergency. And at least before that employee returns to the workplace in the event of travel to any restricted area. Now, generally speaking, giving employees notice of that in advance, and it's along the lines that Jen said, where it's not a precise policy at this point, but rather is flexible and nimble and allows the company to tailor the travel policy to the particular circumstances that may arise. Obviously, any travel policy would also include a provision that indicated that the employer would meet any employer-imposed quarantine on returning travelers. Paid time off policies. Jen.
Okay. Yeah, I previously mentioned paid time off and leave of absence policies and the approach of considering them in buckets. When examining paid time off policies in connection with a pandemic, we really do suggest that you consider the employee grouping approach that we'll go over at the end of this session. Issues such as allowing employees who have used all of their paid time off to borrow paid time off and then accrue it when they return back to work may be a significant consideration, especially for those who are near the end of their paid time off and then are required to take a long period of time off due to these issues. Also, whether to go a step further and require employees who end their employment before they actually have the opportunity to accrue back the borrowed time, are they going to then be required to pay it back? Such policies and repayment agreements would really need to be carefully thought through and drafted after considering applicable state law, which can vary on these issues. Brad, back to you.
Hygiene issues. Dr. McQuillan referenced some real common sense hygiene issues. And it's clear that following recommendations regarding proper hygiene can significantly limit the transfer of these diseases. It also, employees appreciate an employer who is proactive in taking some of these steps that, generally speaking, have minimum financial implications. One, providing hand washing stations and hand washing supplies, including alcohol-based gels, that can be available, you know, in any conference rooms, particularly in group meeting areas, as well as dispersed throughout the floor. The more that those materials are available, the more employees will, as a matter of behavior, simply use them. And their use of them will significantly reduce the transfer of the disease. In addition, you know, regularly cleaning surface areas that can promote the transfer of the disease. And educating employees about not sharing devices or at least cleaning them before using them. Many of you go to gyms now and recognize in the last decade how important it is to wipe down equipment after your use. You know, that's a relatively recent phenomenon, but it's indicative of employees' awareness of the communicable diseases and how that can be avoided.
Okay, Brad, now that you've shown your age and your frequent gym use, let's move to the next thing. The group-by-group approach that I mentioned earlier, this is a suggested framework, again, for considering the plethora and often overlapping medical, employment law, business, and employee relations issues. The approach is really to divide employees into hypothetical groups that would most likely form in the event of a pandemic, and then considering each group, as Brad and I will do now, from the perspective of health-related protections, time away from work, compensation, benefits, and employee incentives. And by employee incentives, of course, I mean the incentives both to come to work when you're not sick and can continue to be productive employees, provided that you're not a significant risk to others, and an incentive to stay home when ill, or if there's a potential that you will spread the virus. So first group, I guess, is we'll start with group number one, good place to start. Healthy employees willing and able to come to work. Well, seems like we shouldn't have to worry about these folks very, very much, but of course we want them to continue to be willing and able to come to work. So how do we keep them safe and productive? The hygiene policies have already been addressed. Dr. McQuillan's advice was excellent. Informing employees about the flu risk was also presented through Dr. McQuillan's presentation, as well as mandatory precautions for employees. And the part that can be a little bit more complicated is, that I addressed earlier, is sharing the information about other at-risk employees. But going with the suggestion that you take that on a case-by-case basis and consult with legal and medical personnel to the extent that you have questions about when and how to communicate people to keep them safe is where we'll leave that one. Brad, group two?
Group two is healthy employees unable to come to work due to a quarantine. In the event that the quarantine is government-ordered and the employees are required to stay at work, is the employer permitted in that circumstance not to pay on a daily basis salaried employees in any particular work week? The answer is that there is no standing order that would give the employer an exception from meeting the salary basis test. But that said, in the event that it was ordered, it would be difficult from an employee morale perspective for an employer to make that decision. Although granted, a shutdown or a furlough of a business can have a significant economic impact. These are things that need to be at least considered so that the company reserves the right to in an emergency plan, to review its practice, you know, in the event of a quarantine or a significant outbreak of a pandemic. Mandatory use of vacation, as we've mentioned a few times, it is important that the company have the flexibility to require its employees to use any accrued paid time off, including vacation or sick pay, to cover a situation where they're unable to come to work either due to a government-ordered quarantine quarantine or to an individual company-instructed quarantine, where an individual employee is instructed, no, you've got to stay home. You have a child that you've been in contact with who has been diagnosed with a serious influenza. We don't want you in the workplace as a result of this until you're past the safe period. We want you to stay home. In that instance, the company wants at least to have the flexibility to be able to require that employee to use accrued paid time off rather than paying the employee, you know, to stay home. Obviously, you know, if the employee in that circumstance can't successfully telecommute and produce productive work from home, that is an entirely legitimate alternative as well.
Okay, group three. These are healthy employees. They're not working though because they're not coming to work because children or other dependent care issues are keeping them home. Example given are healthy children, but the schools are closed. This was something we were very worried about a few days ago, a little bit less so right now. What do we do with these folks? Well, do we want to reward them for staying home to taking care of healthy kids? If they have paid time off, we'll likely allow them to use that time off. What if it's only sick pay and we ordinarily don't allow them to use sick pay unless they're actually ill, the employee is ill? Do we liberalize our policies a little bit and allow people to stay home then? How about requiring them to use vacation? Again, the borrowing issue comes up again. Telecommuting is an interesting issue in this, particularly with this group. These people may be very interested in telecommuting. They don't really have any reason to stay home except to take care of those children, and so no one's sick in the house, and they may feel like they're very able to, capable of working through telecommuting. I took a jab at Brad earlier, so I'll take one at myself now. I can tell you that it can be very hard to be home and to telecommute and to take care of well children at the same time. So do employers want to encourage such behavior? There may be very limited circumstances when that's truly doable. And so the telecommuting policies that Brad mentioned earlier are essential to craft and to make sure that you have good business reasons for saying who can and who cannot telecommute.
All right, group four is healthy employees who are unable to work due to an illness in their family and their need to stay home to care for that family member with the flu. Now, first of all, under the Family Medical Leave Act, a serious health condition is defined generally if the person is incapacitated for more than 3 days and is under the continuing treatment by a healthcare provider. Now, generally speaking, that the continuing treatment of a healthcare provider is a fairly easy standard to satisfy, and if the person is incapacitated because of the flu for 3 or more days, that person is going to be considered to have a serious health condition. Now, under the FMLA, if an employee is required to stay home to be able to care for a covered parent, spouse, or child with a serious health condition, that employee is eligible for FMLA. And many of you know that FMLA includes leave of up to 12 weeks per rolling 12-month period, assuming that the policy has been generated in that fashion, and the employee is guaranteed to be returned to work to their prior position. Now, we did receive a question during the presentation wondering whether FMLA triggered only if the pandemic level rises to a level 6 as determined by the CDC. Importantly, no. FMLA, and FMLA can arise under, you know, any circumstance when the employee is suffering from a serious health condition himself or herself, or alternatively is caring for a covered parent, spouse, or child with a serious health condition. Now, in that event, FMLA does not require that the leave be paid. However, every employer in its FMLA and other paid time off policies is going to be considering whether or not the company will reimburse the employee for up to a certain number of sick days each year, each rolling period. And alternatively, if the employee has exhausted paid sick leave, whether or not the company can require that the employee in that circumstance use any accrued but unused vacation time or other paid time off that may have been accrued. Telecommuting we've already covered. You know, certainly a healthy employee who's caring for an ill family member is going to be limited in the amount of effective work that can be done, but there are many, efficient employees who can multitask and may be able to get at least certain projects done while working from home.
Thanks, Brad. Group number five, healthy employees who do not come to work because they have been exposed, they may have been exposed to the virus. So these are the folks who are have children at a school that are in the same classroom as someone who's been diagnosed with swine flu, for example. Do we need to keep the parents home in that circumstance? And Dr. McClellan said earlier, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. McClellan, that no, right now we don't have any medical reason for having to keep those particular people home from work. If there is a decision, that if instead that the potential exposure has been closer than that, and there is a decision to keep that person home for safety's sake, again, the same kinds of issues arise, although here we don't have those pesky healthy kids or those sick kids around, so telecommuting may be something that people can do in a way that they're not distracted, although there may be that the nature of that of the job does not really allow certain groups of people to telecommute. Of course, you may then have employee relations issues associated with that. This is all about communication, effective planning, and really thinking through these issues. Same issues on time away from work and mandatory use of vacation for employees who are really, in this instance, if we tell them, there could be a big distinction here if the employer tells the employees to stay home versus someone voluntarily staying home because they or staying home because they need to deal with their own personal child care issues or other dependent care issues.
Group six deals with healthy employees who are afraid to come to work. Now, generally speaking, you know, we've said this several times, an employer should rely on the latest up-to-date advice that is coming from the CDC or Department of Public Health regarding the level of concern, particularly in the geographic area in which the employer's facility is located. Fortunately, at this point in time, you know, the advice that is available to every employer via the web through these connections is up-to-date, it's thorough, it's well-reasoned, and every employer, you know, can rely on that in an effort to communicate with the employee who simply says, well, I don't care, I don't want to come to work because I don't want to get sick. And many of you will be faced with that and will determine that, gee, that fear may be unreasonable. At that point, obviously, to the extent that rational communication with such an employee is not effective, the employer could, in an instance, say, well, we are going to require you to use some of your accrued time off, including vacation, in the event that you stay out, because otherwise your absenting yourself from work is not going to be considered to be authorized. But obviously that needs to be done through a somewhat sensitive communication with the employee, you know, recognizing that there may be other morale issues to the extent among co-employees, as well as the, you know, there are employees who simply are illegitimately and in good faith have a fear of contracting diseases during these periods, and part of that results from some of the press that including the Boston Herald the headline that Dr. McQuillan referenced. So, you know, the company does have some options. The key is to communicate openly with those individual employees in an effort to adopt a reasonable approach in the instance.
Okay, and finally, group seven. Finally, we get to the sick employees. It took us a while to get here. As we mentioned at the beginning, there are all sorts of issues that are associated with people who are not sick. In many respects, the sick employees are the easiest to deal with from an employment law standpoint. They get FMLA. It's most likely a serious health condition. Probably not if it's just garden variety swine flu has been, I don't know if there is garden variety swine flu yet, but the swine flu that has been described so far, it's likely not going to be a disability under the law. However, there could be long-term effects. Certainly some people have died from this condition, and so if people become very ill, then they could develop a disability that requires a reasonable accommodation upon their return or additional time off. Sick people usually get sick pay if it's long enough, short-term disability. The more complicated questions relate to the privacy concerns or protections, I should say, that employees have under the ADA and protects under state law, whether or not there needs to be a reporting. Dr. McClellan covered those points. Dr. McClellan also discussed hypothetically how long an employee should be required to stay away and how long the person should be permitted to stay away, but certainly with respect to the required question, that I think would also be fact-specific and would be the kind of thing that you may consider talking with someone like Dr. McClellan more specifically about a case if you have questions about the length of time that the person should be away from work. And then notification of employees, and one thing we didn't mention before, but also it can be a very sensitive topic, which is not just notifying people within the workplace, but if you have, let's say, somebody who has been in regular contact with customers or clients during the incubation period, how, if at all, should we notify those customers as well? And again, that would really be determined on a case-by-case basis.
Our final slide is a rundown of the most relevant written employment policies that each employer should consider revising or consider that they do have all the necessary flexibility to address in the event of a significant outbreak and resulting absenteeism for both actively sick as well as well, but employees who are going to be instructed to work from home. These are the policies that each of you should consider. They're part of an emergency plan that is a nimble, evolving a plan document that does react to the current circumstance that may be presented. We do have time just for a few questions that did come in. I want to ask Dr. McQuillan, first of all, we have one question that came in. It says, we are a financial institution, and the majority of our employees are exposed to many exposures, including money. Does the flu virus live on porous surfaces such as money?
It's a good question, actually. It certainly can survive, again, 2 to 8 hours on any surface, including porous surfaces. There are actually more specific cleaning requirements for things like rugs and fabrics and that sort of thing. However, in this setting, it's probably aimed at bank tellers and people like that who are going to have transient exposures to people. The money they handle is likely to be contained in something most of the time, like a wallet or a purse, and so it's not going to have that much exposure to someone coughing or sneezing on it. I think it would be a good general policy for someone in that kind of position to have perhaps a personal container of alcohol-based hand rub that they could use periodically, particularly if they're concerned. For instance, if a person comes up, they're coughing and sneezing like crazy, you do your transaction, then wash your hands.
Okay, great. Thanks. Jen, a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
If a company needs to close and people are home for more than 1 week, are those employees eligible for unemployment in Massachusetts, or should the company alternatively lay them off?
Okay. Well, I'm glad the question says in Massachusetts, because this really is state-specific and would depend on the particular unemployment statute. But no, there's not a requirement to lay them off. This would be akin to a furlough. If employees are not allowed to come to work, there is a mandatory waiting period of 1 week. But after that, if employees are not receiving pay and suffer a compensation loss because they're out of work due to the company closing down in the event of a pandemic, then they would likely be eligible for unemployment.
Good. Thanks. One last point. You know, I've mentioned the development of a written emergency plan several times. I've indicated that presently, under the federal OSHA law, the development of that plan is voluntary. It is not mandatory. That said, importantly, there are many state safety programs. They're called state OSHA programs that do require illness prevention plans. One state in particular, the most popular one, is California, and CalOSHA does require the development of a written illness prevention plan, and certainly that illness prevention plan should include provisions that address any potential pandemic. All right. This concludes our presentation. Thank you very much for your participation. You'll see that a quick survey has appeared on your screen. Please take a moment to complete that so that we can continue to create seminars and webinars with content that is of interest to you and that provides a value add for both you and your company. Also, for those of you who missed our introduction, note that an audio recording of today's presentation, as well as the PowerPoint slides, will be made available for viewing and downloading on our website, www.goodwinproctor.com. Also, watch your email for information on how to access our presentation materials or check our homepage or the Labor and Employment Practice Area page over the next few days. Now, if you have any specific questions relating to your business, including the status of your employment policies or treatment of particular employees who may have been exposed to swine flu, of course, Jennifer and I are available to work with you. And in addition, Dr. McQuillan is continuing to keep apprised regarding the latest medical and epidemiological data concerning this virus and is available to consult with you regarding medical and public health issues that may arise. I believe that Dr. McQuillan's CV, as well as contact information, will be available through the Goodwin Proctor website. Thank you for joining us today. Goodbye.